This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh, and today I'm very glad to be speaking with Dr. Michael Johnston. Professor Michael Johnston is a professor of, is an associate professor of English at Purdue University, and he's published a book with Oxford University Press called The Middle English Book, Scribes and Readers, 1350 to 1500. Michael, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we start the interview and talking about the book, could you please briefly introduce yourself? And I'm really interested to know how you became interested in medieval English and especially the culture of writing books in medieval English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm an associate professor, as you said, at Purdue University. We're in West Lafayette, Indiana, so about 2 hours from Chicago, for those who aren't familiar with us. And I've been teaching here since 2008. I got interested in medieval literature, particularly. It's a very common story among medievalists. I had a class, an undergraduate class, where we discussed King Arthur and the whole concept of a central character sort of evolving across time and being used by different authors just totally grabbed me. And I knew that I wanted to go to graduate school and I wanted to continue pursuing medieval literature. When I got to graduate school, I did my master's degree at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And one of the first days there, they pulled out some medieval manuscripts, and just having the contact with them was enough for me to realize that I wanted to sort of, you know, pursue research on that topic. So I came back to the States, did a PhD at Ohio State University, and that's where I sort of really dove into the cultures of manuscripts, and I've been working on that ever since.
And we'll talk about the concept of a manuscript or a book soon, but before that, how did this book come about, the Middle English book? Why did you decide to write a book about different types of books, if I may say so, use that word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, they are books, so a perfect term to use. I wrote my first book in 2014 on the genre of Middle English romance and focused on the manuscripts of romance. So it was a kind of narrow study of this particular genre. But as I started working with doing the work on that first book about manuscripts, I kind of started wanting to look at other texts beyond romance, started wanting to look at Chaucer manuscripts, started, you know, wanting to look at a whole host of other sort of things that people were reading in order to contextualize the work that I was doing on romance. And I didn't have time to talk about any of that stuff in the first book. So I just kind of kept coming back to it. And so I kind of cast my net wider and wanted to really, in this book, I had the luxury of having more time to work on this book. So I really wanted to think about kind of loosely how books worked as objects in culture in the late manuscript period, kind of right before the printing press, but when we had a real proliferation of vernacular literature. And so, yeah, this was the fruit of sort of 9 to 10 years of just sort of going back and casting my net more widely and going back to the archives and looking at more and more manuscripts and sort of seeing if I couldn't come up with a kind of wider, more interesting, more cohesive argument about how manuscripts worked in culture.
And I studied English myself, but my field of study wasn't really medieval English. And after I graduated, I became more interested in the whole medieval culture, history, simply because of all the stereotypes around it. We wrongly call it Dark Ages. But then when you go and study, you found lots and lots of books, this culture of research and writing books. And I came to kind of pick up some of the nuances in the idea of book. But again, before coming to your book, I would just use the term manuscript or a book. But anyhow, you kind of problematize the existing vocabulary to talk about books or manuscript in the Middle Ages, and you feel that this is inadequate. So why is it that the existing vocabulary is inadequate to describe the different types of manuscripts they've had in the Middle Ages?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's really, I think that was that sort of dissatisfaction with the way we talk about books in existing scholarship was really at the root of was driving a lot of the early thinking for this book. I think the reason I found it unsatisfactory was simply that it was extremely impressionistic without being able to define terms of use. So, for example, I have the whole first chapter of the book talks about, it's called Nomenclature, and it talks about the different terms we use. And one of the things I really became dissatisfied with was just how impressionistic the way we use terminology was. And for example, we'll talk about someone will isolate a particular manuscript and say, oh, this is a commercial manuscript, or this is made by a professional scribe. But we don't have the other side of that. We don't have a lot of historical evidence for what was a professional scribe, or what did, you know, an industry of commercial book production look like. And so we're kind of, very impressionistically looking at a manuscript and saying, oh, this is fancier. Implicitly, this is what we're doing. This is fancier than the things I'm used to seeing, or what in my experience is a quote-unquote average manuscript, so I'll call this professional, without having a real sense of what that meant on the ground. And so, I think that's understandable. I'm very careful in this chapter to say, like, look, we all do this because it's the best we can do. I did it myself. I quote myself, you know, using these terms in what I now think are sort of unsatisfying ways. But it makes sense because manuscripts are really hard to work with. They take a lot of time to work with one manuscript and really try to get your mind around it. And so to try to talk about with a sort of more cohesively across culture how manuscripts worked is really difficult. And so I think it's really understandable that, you know, you spend all your time working on one manuscript or a small corpus, you have to use terms, but we haven't had the sort of external evidence to flesh out those terms. So my book was looking for a sort of different way than the sort of impressionistic mode of looking at a manuscript and kind of judging it based on just the other things you happen to have looked at.
And then you come up with your categorization. And one of the elements used is the proximity of users and producers, which I found really interesting. So can I talk about your categorization to address this inadequacy? And what is that, let's say, criteria that use the proximity of users and producers?
Yeah, so this is, again, the project started with this dissatisfaction. And I said, like, let me go look at a large corpus and see if I can't kind of think through better ways to discuss to discuss books and come up with better terminology. And what really jumped out at me was we all assume, and I think for good reason, that almost all manuscripts are bespoke. And that's a term that listeners may be familiar with, but it's worth pondering here and unpacking for a moment. So in terms of production of any sort of item, I think you have basically two, we have a kind of polarity here. You have bespoke production, which is the user and producer meet at some point, and the producer says, or the user says, the commissioner says, you know, I want thing X made with, you know, with these criteria, and then the producer goes and makes it on commission for someone. And the other end of the spectrum would be commodity production, where, you know, think of like a vending machine full of bottles of Coca-Cola or something. Like, they're all made in anticipation of a market, but they're not made for a particular user. And so it really struck me that the bespoke nature of manuscripts is really essential. And so what does it mean for something to be bespoke? Well, as I started putting more pressure on that, you realize that, well, users and producers are meeting at a certain juncture to create the manuscript, but that point of meeting can take on a variety of forms. And so that's where my replacement for the sort of impressionistic terminology came from, is thinking about, we actually can have some evidence from the manuscripts themselves about the forms of interaction that likely took place, or the proximity that likely lies behind these books, the proximity in terms of the users and producers, or the scribes and readers, if you want to say. So that exploring the variety of forms that intersection can take on, that arises from the evidence of the books themselves, is kind of where I started to develop a new methodology for understanding books.
And I previously, that was, I guess, a couple of years ago, I talked to someone, Mary Wellesley, who wrote a book about, it was medieval, Invisible Hands, I guess. It was about the culture of producing books. It was more or less a kind of a pop story, and it was written for more general audience. And I'm into, and then
yeah,
I came
to... Sorry, did you say that's Mary Wellesley?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I reviewed her book. I forget the title of it off the top of my head, but yeah, it was great.
Invisible Hands, or don't remember exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it came under two different titles. The other one was Gilded. Gilded Age.
That's the one I read. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. But that, like, this gave me some understanding of how complex and difficult it was to produce a manuscript. And I'm really interested in knowing about this. For example, you talk about, I'm interested to know, first of all, were books produced in one location, especially illustrated manuscripts, which I guess involved several different authors. And what evidence do we have, or what evidence, or what kind of method did you use to find the evidence that manuscripts, for example, were produced in different locations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great question, because it kind of just gets at the whole methodology my entire book. If you take illustrated manuscripts, for example, highly decorated books, those are the sorts of books, I think, where you can start to posit, that's the sort of evidence that you can look for in a book, that you can start to posit that there probably is a greater distance between the user and the producer. Because historically, we know that that book illustration, and I'm thinking of not like simple like colored letters, but like gold and complex, the illuminations that, you know, we're familiar with as sort of iconographic examples of medieval books. We know that historically, much of that work was done in cities, in centralized locations. And so we have evidence for book artists congregating in cities, and this, I think, is what art historians have more or less determined, is that most of this was done locally. There were exceptions. There were peripatetic artists who would go to you, but as I understand the work of art historians, it tends to be a kind of centralized thing. So if you have a book that is very highly decorated, you can then assume that whoever the ultimate user was, they had to. You know, there had to be some process of getting the commission sent through these local, through these centralized locations. In England, particularly by the late 14th century and into the 15th century, the period that I'm looking at, a lot of the higher end book decorators are understandably centralized in London. But if you think of the other end of the book, a kind of plain book, that just is, you know, text in black ink, that's the kind of thing that can be done that doesn't require one to posit that it was done in a centralized location, because writing is a much less specialized craft than decorating. Writing is done, there's bureaucracies throughout late medieval England, and all kinds of, you know, small institutions as small as a household and a parish. And so, because writing is much more decentralized and much more widespread than illustrating, you sort of have, you know, the less illustrated, the less fancy a book is, the more likely it could be made in proximity to the user. So those are the sorts of the sorts of pieces of evidence that I'm using to sort of start to categorize books based on the proximity of users to producers. I realize I've strayed from your original question about book decoration, but it's kind of like the starting point of the greatest distance, putative distance between users and producers is the really highly decorated book.
And do we know much about these professional artists or scribes who produce these manuscripts?
You're wading into some of the most contested territory in scholarship. So, actually questions that I studiously sidestep or maintain a study.
Yeah, it's just my curiosity to ask you.
No, it's great. I mean, and stuff that I have, you know, that I'm certainly conversant with, but don't try to weigh in on so much of my own work. In terms of artists, and if we're talking about scribes, that's much more in my wheelhouse. I feel much more competent to at least weigh in on that. If we're talking about artists, I'm purely sort of secondhand repeating what the scholarship says, because I don't, in my own work, kind of get into analyzing art. But if you start with the first part of your question, which was about book artists, as I understand the methodology of art historians, you kind of look at a series of illustrations, and based on isolating particular features, you will say that, oh, that is by the same author or the same artist as that. So you can kind of compare across illustrations. And a few of those have been able to be attributed to named artists, because there will be an artist who will sign his work on occasion, or they will have a document that sort of says so-and-so was the scribe who did this manuscript, and then you identify the manuscript elsewhere and you can put them together that way. But even those identifications end up coming up under critique. So just as an example, the most prolific artist from England in the 15th century is named William Abel, A-B-E-L. And there's sort of debate about how many, you know, originally there's a scholar who, you know, created a canon of Abel's illustrations, and then other people have started sort of paring that back. So these are controversial, and they're not certainly black and white. In terms of the scribes, I think it's a similar sort of methodology that people have employed, because most manuscripts are not signed by the scribe. So you're in a lucky situation if you can match the hand of a manuscript with a document that is signed, or you have a name. And then if you can confidently assert that the thing with the person's name is the same as the same handwriting as the manuscript in question, that's when you start to create the argument that, Joe Schmo over here who signed this document is the scribe of this manuscript because it's in the same hand. Again, those are controversial, methodologically really controversial. That's kind of where a lot of the heat has been in, like, at least vernacular manuscript studies in the past 10 to 15 years, kind of arguing over the methodology of this and particular identifications.
Let's talk about the types of magazines that were produced. And you talk about religious houses. What sort of manuscripts were produced in religious houses in terms of genre? For me, I know that's a more or less a modern term, but
yeah, no, that's a great question. So I mean, we think of, yeah, you talked earlier about the stereotypes around the Middle Ages, and you know, all books were made by monks in monasteries. This is sort of that stereotype. And that's, like, you know, there's some truth to that, in that up to around 1100, this is the typical historical narrative, is up to about 1100, monopolies had more or less monasteries, houses of religion, houses of monks. And at that point, it's mostly Benedictine monks, had a monopoly over textual production, certainly production of manuscripts. And after about 1100, it starts to sort of move out into the secular world, at least as an alternative or another site of manuscript production. For the kind of stuff that I'm doing, by the 15th century, monasteries are still producing books, mostly Latin, you know, materials for devotional purposes, for in-house purposes. I'm working on literary manuscripts. I'm interested in the culture of reading. And there's very little literary manuscripts being very, very, actually, very few literary manuscripts being produced in monasteries. Of the text that I looked at, and I'm sure we'll get into this as we go, I looked at a corpus of 202 manuscripts for this project, and maybe 8 of them can be attributed to religious houses. There's a great research project called the Corpus of British of catalogs from British medieval libraries, I think it's called. It's produced by the British Academy, and they go through and edit all of the different institutions from the Middle Ages that had catalogs of their books. So it's not about the surviving books, but it's about their internal catalogs. And if you isolate the religious houses, you can just go through the indexes of these, and you see how few vernacular texts were owned by monastic houses. So it seems to have been sort of a thing that is in the secular world, secular meaning not part of monastic houses.
And again, one of the terms you use there is streamlined books. Mm-hmm. What are streamlined books, and how are they different from books produced in different locations?
Yeah. I think to help contextualize that term, it would probably help if I step back a little bit and return to this question of my methodology of trying to get on impressionistic vocabulary to figuring out the sort of relationship between users and producers that the evidence of the books themselves can lead us to. So what I essentially did in this project was, instead of as part of my dissatisfaction with the terminology that we've been using, was that people would specialize in a certain type of book. Like people work on Chaucer manuscripts, or I was a scholar who worked on manuscripts of Middle English Romance, and on and on. Instead, what I tried to do is I picked 4 texts that were relatively diverse and tried to look at all of the surviving copies of those, thinking that would give me a fairly wide net. And so the streamlined books are one of the categories I developed to say, I think we can profitably arrange books based on the proximity or distance between users and producers. So earlier we talked about those highly decorated books, and I posit that as the category of the elaborate book, which you have to assume the greatest distance between users and producers. That's the sort of thing where someone had to send away to a metropole where, book artists were congregated. The streamlined book is the next kind of category that I propose, and that is a very common sort of book where there aren't any bells and whistles. You don't need to posit a sort of high-end decorator, but the evidence shows that it was made for a single commission. And so this is the kind of book where they're often pretty plain. You might have decorated initials. It's often have blue and red paraffs, what we call paraff signs, that will sort of divide stanzas of poems up and such. But essentially, it's usually made by one scribe, and it's copied, seriatim. Like if there's 1 or 2 or 3 texts, they just kind of proceed in a row. And so it's the kind of thing where you imagine that someone went to a scribe and said, "I want a copy of this text or these 2 texts," and then the scribe's turning it around as quickly as he can because he wants to make his money and get on to the next commission. So it's the kind of book that has codicological evidence from the books themselves that would indicate a kind of direct, made on commission and made in a very straightforward way. And so I call them streamlined because the process is to be as sort of economical as possible to get the book back to the reader and move on to the next commission.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you seem to have been muted. I'm not able to hear you.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Accidentally muted my microphone.
No worries. Yeah.
And there's another category, which is evolving books. Mm-hmm. So what is that category? How is it different from others?
Yeah. So again, I do the categories I propose are based on like increasing proximity, increasing closeness between users and producers. So again, the elaborate book, the highly decorated book, which you have to send away for, is the most distance. And then the streamlined book looks like it's made on commission. And so it's the kind of thing where it seems to be someone maybe slightly further or slightly closer to you than the elaborate book, but not probably someone in your household, because the evolving book is the next category, which is where you have books that are changing as you go. And so what I'm positing lying behind those is some kind of I keep coming back to the term proximity, but I'll use it because it works here. Some kind of regular standing relationship between the people making the books and the people for whom they are eventually made. And that, and what I mean by that is just there's lots of books that very clearly kind of change their design as they're in process. So whereas the Streamline book was like one or two or three texts like produced clearly to a preordained plan, sticks to that and is done. The Evolving book is the kind of thing where you might have a team of scribes. So say you have one scribe who copies a poem and then he steps away, and 20 pages later he might copy 10 pages in a row and then he steps away, and then 30 pages later he might copy another single poem, and then in between you have another scribe doing something sort of irregular like this. And you might have one part of the book. So books were made in choirs, like they still are today. If you look at if you open up a printed book, you'll see how the groups of the pages are, you know, you don't have a 100-page book isn't 50 pages of paper folded inside each other. They're little groups. So, but choirs are free-floating entities. So you might, in an Evolving book, you might have one choir that's about one set of texts, and it seems to grow or be truncated as it's going. So you can have kind of moving parts of this book that don't get put together until the very end. And so there's all kinds of evidence inside of books that show that they're evolving. They're being sort of changed as they go. And I think that implies some sort of proximity between users and producers, because you know, what else is going to dictate, you know, I want to add this text to this section, or that section should be focused on medical texts and this section should be focused on devotional texts. And so those sort of, you know, decisions that are being made on the fly, I think imply pretty confidently, I think, a kind of standing relationship between users and producers.
And do we know what kind of, again, for the interest of the audience, what kind of books or topics they generally covered in these Evolving books?
I would hesitate to make a kind of overarching comments across all of literary culture or literary culture, because I'm, you know, I focused on these four literary texts, and so the things that fell in within my remit I feel kind of comfortable talking about. But I think in general there, it's miscellaneity that is one of the features of these books, because so for example, you will find like texts that are exclusively focused on medicine. Right. Mm-hmm. So you might have a whole treatise on the plague followed by recipes, and recipes are kind of accretive. Right. They grow by accretion. So you'll have recipes will tend to be like on loose leaves at the end of a book, and you might have many, many scribes coming along. So it's the kind of thing where a new recipe came to your attention, you jot it down in the book. So you will get these kind of evolving books that have lots of medical, so they can be focused on medicine. You'll get other evolving books that might be focused on, for example, devotional texts. So devotional texts, there's a lot of short devotional texts. There'll be prayers and such. And so those are the kind of things that can grow by accretion too. So you will have some sort of themed, what I call evolving books, but then you also have some that are clearly just what I call grab bags. You know, you'll have like a literary text, you might have a romance, you might have a snippet of Chaucer, then you might have a bunch of medical recipes, and then you'll have a devotional text, and then you'll have another literary text, and then you'll have, you know, a text about caring for your horse. And they, you know, you will get this sort of grab bag, which again, I think what kind of book, if you're making a book like that for someone else, what's going to dictate that kind of crazy miscellaneity, except that the person for whom you're making the book is in kind of regular contact saying, yeah, add that. Or, yeah, I want more medical text, that sort of thing. I just don't know how else you would account for that kind of miscellaneity unless there's a kind of proximity between the person who's going to end up with the book and the people making the book.
And again, reading your book and listening to it just goes to show how different types of scholarship people or scribes, or in general, people in the Middle Ages were interested in. It was not necessarily, because again, one of the cliches is that it's all religious art or religious texts, but now it's science, medicine, astronomy.
Absolutely. I mean, whatever was available that could be written down, people wanted to read. I mean, obviously you have different communities wanting different kind of readers, wanting different kind of texts, but there's a huge diversity of texts. And yeah, the idea that the Middle Ages is entirely about piety and devotion and theology while that is certainly much more dominant than it is today, they had extremely varied interests, cultural interests that they sought in their reading matter, for sure.
And I want to ask you about the dynamic between readers and between producers and users. But before that, there was another category that I really found interesting: do-it-yourself books. And I'm really interested in this one, given the technology really wasn't there to mass produce books, and it certainly wasn't easy, enormous amount of time and labor required. So what were these do-it-yourself books, and what was the point of these books or manuscripts?
Yeah, thank you for asking about this. This is the final category of books. I should credit, I got the title of the category from Julia Boffey's book on books from London. She has a study of books from London from, I think, 1475 to 1525. So it's late manuscript and early print. And so she studies books that are related to London from that period. And she used the term DIY book. And I was like, that's exactly what I'm after in this last category. And that is where the distance between users and producers is gone, and that users are producers. It's kind of collapsed into one. In other words, it's a DIY book, do-it-yourself book, because you're making the book for yourself. And this is very much a live option in the late Middle Ages. There are examples where you'll have like lay people producing books for their household. There's a famous one in the Bodleian Ashmole 61 where the scribe signs his name a bunch of times, so we know it's got to be by this guy because he's not shy about splashing his name across the manuscript. And it seems to be a lay householder. It could be a priest copying books for the household. We don't know for certain who this guy was, but it's a collection of books that would be a collection of texts that would be useful for a house. There's entertainment texts, there's romances, but there's also like a poem called Rules for Purchasing Land, which doesn't sound very literary, but it teaches you how to like profitably acquire more property. So there's those kinds of secular books. Then we have examples of monks and priests copying books for themselves as well. So that could be for like private reading, could be for use in their clerical duties. So there's a whole range of texts, but the idea is that if you were literate and you had access you had a text that you were interested in, you wanted your own copy. I mean, nowadays you just go on Amazon or you'd photocopy. If there was a short poem, you could take a screenshot or shot with your phone or something. But back in the late manuscript period, lots of people copied their own books. So I presumably you'd borrow the exemplar from someone if you found a text you liked, and then you just sit down to produce your own copy.
I think to bring it all the discussion together in general, the criteria that you use and this relationship between producers and users, how does it show this dynamic between the user and producers of the texts?
So can you just clarify what you mean by this question?
Well, Sam,
so
you're asking, does it what in terms of the relationship between these, what does this idea of proximity tell us? And I'm also curious to know if we know anything about readers, but I know that that's not a topic that you cover in the book. So I'm just asking that if you might have come across something.
For sure. So I guess that's, again, getting at the real heart of what I'm after in this book. And that is that I'm pushing away from thinking about I want us to think about the manuscript book as a fundamentally different artifact than the printed book, because the printed book is a commodity. The books, if we use the term book and just think it's a stable concept, us in 2024, we in 2024 using the term, it can be a little bit misleading. And so what I'm trying to get at with this, with my book, with my study, is that manuscripts were made at a juncture where two human beings came together. Right, you have a user and a producer, and that is kind of the animating concept behind what, you know, it's like the core of what a manuscript book is. Now, in my book, I'm trying to flesh out the fact that that point of juncture can take on a variety of forms, and it can be something that's kind of like a commodity when you're sending off to have a high-end book made. There's a kind of great distance between you, as there is today, a great distance between us and the books that we read. But books can come all the way, you know, the kind of distance can collapse all the way to the point that people are making their own books. And in the realm of books, that's not something that really exists very much anymore today. We've lost the like sense of people making their own books because books are such a commodity. So I'm just trying, I was trying to kind of recover the, what you might call the kind of sociology or anthropology of reading, or of owning literature and producing literature. As far as readers, I use reader as just a, probably a stable concept. I use producer and user, or reader and scribe. They're kind of interchangeable terms. As the person who owns the book, in terms of how they engage with the text and the kind of, you know, what readers are doing with their text is not something I'm taking up in this book. Mm-hmm. I sort of just am working with the assumption that the user is the stable entity that receives the text from, you know, the text that they commissioned from whoever made the book for them, or if it's a DIY person, they're making it for themselves. It's a separate set of kind of methodological investigations in terms of what readers did with their books. I think it's a fascinating set of questions. It's just not what I'm getting into in this book, because it's probably too long. My study is probably too long as it is, but I love these kind of reader questions. Mm. Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, you're right. And I guess it kind of requires a whole different book to be written about the dynamics between readers and scribes. But anyway, and again, just to show how, because I guess I mentioned at the beginning that I'm not really an expert in medieval literature. I'm just an enthusiast. And up to a few years ago, I used to think that, for example, Chaucer wrote his own poems and then he had the manuscripts.
Nothing. Well, probably we have no autograph, you know, anything written in Chaucer's hand. Another contested question. Yeah.
So a lot of times, I guess I'm guessing that the authors had the materials, whatever it was, but you had scribes writing and also decorating those writings.
Mm-hmm.
Before we come to the end of the question, I always ask this question. Is there any other projects that you're working on, any books that we might expect to see anytime soon?
Well, soon in academic terms, maybe, but of course we work slowly, especially people who work on manuscripts. So don't expect anything to like come out in a year, in the next year or so. But I'm working on a related set of projects about the manuscripts of one of the four poems that I tackle in my book is called The Prick of Conscience. It was, at least to judge by number of surviving manuscripts, it was the most popular piece of verse in English from the Middle Ages. So it's one of the four texts, as I said, that I look at in my book. So in my book, I've already kind of looked at all of the copies of this poem, but I was using it as one of the pieces of evidence to enter in the book that we're talking about here, to enter into this discussion about the sort of users versus producers. So now in this current project, I'm doing two different things. I'm along with Dr. David Gura, who is the rare books and manuscripts librarian at the University of Notre Dame, where they own a fragment of The Prick of Conscience. He and I have been collaborating on a catalog of the manuscripts of The Prick of Conscience, so detailed descriptions of each manuscript, sort of thinking about how many scribes are involved, what other texts it's copied with, what the material it's copied on, relationships between texts. So we're kind of slowly working our way through all of the copies and writing detailed descriptions. And then I'm working on a book, which is just going to be a series of essays about what we find out by really studying the whole corpus of the Prick of Conscience manuscripts, because I just scratched the surface in my book. And as I said, like the Prick of Conscience is just at the service of a narrative about in my book is at the service of a narrative about manuscript culture in general. So for this project, I'm really trying to look at things like, well, you asked about reader response. I'm really looking at where did scribes tend to put their emphasis in their marginal notation? Scribes and readers tend to put their emphasis in their marginal notation. What, because the Prick of Conscience is about, it's the word prick means to like prod or goad to goad your conscience into reforming your life as you prepare for death, which can be coming for anyone at any moment. And so, you know, it talks about the like the decrepitude of the human body, the pains of hell, the joys of heaven, you know, why you shouldn't trust certain parts of earthly life, etc. And so I want to go through and really study, like, where were people pausing and underlining or saying, you know, note this. And then I'm also interested in thinking about where Renaissance, early modern readers, after the Reformation, this text continued to be owned. And so you'll have people kind of carrying out debates about Protestantism versus Catholicism in the margins. And you'll have clearly Catholic reader, post-Reformation readers writing kind of approbatory comments. And then you'll have Reformation readers saying, like, this is BS and blah, blah, blah. So kind of tracing out the cultural history of this really important poem through its manuscripts. That's the book that I'm working on.
Well, certainly hope to be able to talk to you about that book. But I'm sure that, as you said, it takes time. But I'll keep my eyes open.
Great.
Dr. Michael Jensen, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about your wonderful book, the Middle English book, Scribes, Readers, 1350 to 1500, published by Oxford University Press.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.